Hello everyone and welcome to this panel discussion on managing and mitigating third-party information risk in the connected enterprise. Yet again we have a great panel lined up for you and I'm going to hand straight over to our moderator of the session, Mike St. John Green, who's Principal Analyst and Technical Advisor at the Information Security Forum.
Yes, so I'm going to make the briefest of introductions before I introduce the panel. I'm going to ask them to tell us a little bit about how they see this question, and then I'm going to open it up for questions from you as quickly as we can, because I think that's where we'll get most of the value. So think up some of those penetrating questions for our panel today. Why are we here? The supply chain, I mean, the drive for efficiency and creating profit means that our organizations have changed. We focus on what we're good at. We outsource the rest. And of course, that means that our vital information is being shared with this increasingly complex supply chain, creating a much wider attack surface for the criminals and others to attack us. And to the degree that that sensitive data now resides in multiple locations, including in the cloud, the question, I guess, is, what is it we need to do about it? And we've got some questions here. We're looking for practical steps so that we can deliver security to enable that business growth. We're looking for some thought leadership here to make sure that this subject is actually properly understood at that corporate level on that board agenda. To understand the threats, both internal and external, and we must remember, of course, the insider threat. Within the supply chain, you now have a very large population of people who are privileged, effectively insiders. Return on investment, actually a difficult issue if you can't come up with that narrative that is understood at the board level. And how to balance the risk versus the opportunity. There's no point actually denying ourselves the opportunity of using the supply chain by being afraid of the risks. So how to manage that. So without further ado, I'm going to briefly introduce our panel. We have first Will Harvey from HMRC, Deputy Director, well, Will, remind me.
Deputy Director of Security and Information.
Thank you, yeah. Deputy Director of Security and Information. And then moving along, we have Arno Via, Chief Information Security Officer, TNT Express. Yeah, Mark Jones, CISO for Allen and Overy. Steve Williamson, Director Governance and Risk Compliance from GSK, GlaxoSmithKline. And last but certainly not least, Daniela Catadou, who comes from the Cloud Security Alliance, a really interesting topic, of course, cloud here, and he is their Chief Technology Officer. You've heard enough from me, I think. I'm going to hand over to Will. And Will, what are your thoughts on this subject?
So thanks, Mike. I think you catch me at a time of interesting change, both in government and my own department. So as a large government organization, you can probably imagine we have a significant supply chain to manage. The change in question we're going through is moving from where we've had a large system integrator who's been doing a lot of assurance of third and fourth parties on our behalf to where we're taking many more suppliers in-house. So the questions we're kind of asking ourselves, aside from seeing this as a sort of source of general kind of day-to-day terror, is can we use this as an opportunity to really take a step back and look at how we manage a large number of suppliers, what kind of relationships do we want to put in place, and how can we get it to focus much more on risk than straightforward compliance. Having direct engagement with many more suppliers means that we have to find a way to prioritize them, not just on their size or strategic value to the organization, but also on how well we know them, if we have a long-standing relationship or not. Are they familiar with some of the kind of foibles of doing business with government or not? May they need additional assistance there? Part of that discussion means engaging a lot more internally with the business so that as a security team, we can actually understand what is being outsourced or delivered for us, what the relevance of it to the organization is. And that can then inform the basis of our dialogue with those suppliers. More broadly in government, I think we're moving slowly from a place of where we've been quite rigid with our suppliers. We've often given a lot of rote, backed by a significant amount of process, and having to accommodate a lot more approaches to security, be a lot more flexible in the approaches we want. So rather than simply say, this is the standard we require, to look at what certifications providers already have, and to understand what that might not cover that we want to base a conversation on and base our risk management on going forwards. I think the last theme is that we have more suppliers that potentially we're not directly procuring. Some of them may be ones we're not even paying. We're just using a lot more commodity cloud services. And keeping visibility of those presents its own unique challenges.
Thanks, Will. It sounds like there's a rocket taking off adjacent to our room, but I see the team have gone off to sort it out. So we'll press on. Just picking up a couple of your noting a couple of your points, I'd certainly like to return to this question of the balance between risk and compliance. And maybe we can draw out some questions. Maybe you can prompt us there as an audience. And that rigidity versus flexibility, I detected there's quite a lot in here about the nature of the relationship.
Yeah.
I think this would be a good point to move on to Arno.
Yeah. I think that's important. At the end of the day, there's this notion that you can outsource things and that we've got these third parties and third-party relationships. At the end of the day, one way of seeing it, and I think it's the most productive way of seeing it, is that ultimately your third parties are like an extension of your own team. And so I think there's a lot of merit in when you're looking at the relationship that you have with third parties is to try and see whether you're exploiting some of the opportunities that you would with your own team. So how do you manage that relationship from beginning to end? A little bit like a marriage, I dare say. So ultimately, there's going to be good times, there's going to be bad times, and you need to figure out how you navigate those waters. It would be naive and fairly optimistic to assume that you'll only have good times. And of course, when times are good, things are easy. Nothing needs to really be discussed. You do what was engaged in the relationship. When things start going wrong, that's really where things get tested. And I think ultimately then it comes down to human relationships. So if you have got third parties, you should have a relationship with these people. You should know them by name. You should be able to contact them at the drop of a hat. I think it's important that third-party relationships will always be governed primarily by contracts, legal agreements. But ultimately, those are pieces of paper that manage the good times and the bad times. But there will be times where you need to go outside of the contract. And the only way you go outside of the contract is if you have a relationship already established, that then you can apply a sort of reasonable man principle when things go wrong, so that you're not just bound by the terms of the contract. When things go wrong, the last thing you want is people to start paging through 500-page contracts to find a clause that they remember saying. I think the other thing to bear in mind is that relationships with outsourced providers are typically multi-year. Means that the people that engaged in the contract and discussed the contract, agreed the contract up front, most of the time are not there through the length of that relationship. And so at the end of the day, I think the success or failure of a third-party outsourcing agreement is really contingent on the kind of relationships that you've built throughout the contract and that you foster and manage throughout the entirety of the relationship.
That's a really interesting point, that the relationship between the suppliers outlasts the people who actually manage it, and so it needs to be greater than the people themselves. And this point about marriage, I'm about to say something dangerous, so I see how well this works. But to me, if you think about a marriage, you may hold hands, but let us not imagine that the two parties in the marriage see the world the same way, maybe not even want the same, sort of have the same goals. But they come to an accommodation and it's mutually beneficial. And I think in the same way with suppliers and acquirers, of course, if there's a mutually beneficial relationship, but we shouldn't for one minute think that we see the world through the same lens. Yeah. I think I got away with that and I'll move on. Mark.
James. Yeah, so I suppose my perspective, I've heard, a whole bunch of conversations around this where people will say things like risk versus compliance. Like, for instance, compliance is a totally different space. The terms I'd like to use are, I'd like to talk about compliance as being more quantitative. And I think that compliance fills a really important need in terms of getting your supply chain to say where they are, having them on the record, and through that, being able to manage sort of certainty and to a certain extent transparency in a supplier relationship. But there's another bit for me as well. So for me, to get more of the risk angle, you need to have, and as my previous speaker was talking about, you need to start building relationships that allow you to qualitatively assess the quality of controls in a supplier environment. So it's really, for me, if you want best value in terms of supplier risk management or information risk management, it's really getting a good combination and balance of this more qualitative, right, you say you have these controls and you've told us at this time and you're on the record, and if you like, a more deep dive qualitative approach that allows you to, for instance, look at risk assessments and actually we would like to see a worst model risk assessment, your typical risk assessment, your best risk assessment. Just in terms of looking at risk assessments qualitatively, you can tell no end about where the supplier is in terms of their general risk management culture. So just summarizing that, I think my take is getting the balance between a sort of quantitative view or a compliance-oriented view and a qualitative view, which is a much more sort of relationship-y, deep dive view. Getting that balance right will give you good good insight into supplier risk. Yeah.
And the point I take away from that, I think, is that there isn't enough time in the day, there isn't enough time in the relationship to be able to assess every last thing to
Absolutely.
Every last detail.
Absolutely.
So what do we do? How do we get that balance right? I think another topic maybe for us to pursue.
Yep.
Steve Williamson from GSK, what are your thoughts?
Well, we are quite a big user of cloud services, especially software as a service, and a very good business reasons for doing that. But when you start going to the cloud, you do introduce more risk. For example, you've got access from anywhere, any device, so that there's an increased risk of password theft, for example. But in security, we need to enable the business to adopt cloud, but do so securely. And here's the problem. When you adopt cloud, your data is suddenly at the mercy of another company's policies and working practices. One thing I've observed over the last 6-7 years is increased maturity in cloud service providers in terms of security. In particular, more and more are using security as a differentiator. So now when we adopt a cloud service, we do quite a comprehensive security assessment. It's relatively easy to get certifications, independent audit reports, SOC 2, penetration test reports, and have a meaningful discussion. And from that, we can get a really good feel for the strength of their security capability. 5-6 years ago, that wasn't the case. So it's really good to see that maturity coming up. And the fact is, cloud service providers do need to be a leading edge at security. They are a bigger target, and there are more risks in open access to the cloud. The many responsibilities we have as a client as well, but my key point just now is that cloud services are getting better with security. They see it's more and more important. As a business, they recognize the importance of security, and well, long may that continue. We need to keep pushing that.
Mm. Thanks. Something that comes to mind just listening to that is, as users, we have responsibilities when we take a cloud service. Maybe we'll come back to that discussion. So I, as a user, what should I be doing to ensure that my use of cloud is secure? And well, what better transition to the Cloud Services Alliance? Daniela Katadu, neither a buyer nor a seller, of course, perhaps. Well, I'll leave you to introduce yourself.
So I guess that there is not much to be said after like being the fifth in the line here. But I would like to pick up on a few of the points that my colleagues have made. So Arnaud was referring to this idea of cloud service provider being, or providers being, an extension of your own perimeter. But this communication should be somehow seen as, you know, both direction. Because even from the point of view of the provider, there is a need to be more open, to be more transparent to the customer, so to provide the necessary information for them to perform a proper risk assessment. You were referring to the idea of, yes, quantitative measures are important, but let's focus also on qualitative assessment. Now, from my point of view, that it might be a danger in the long run, meaning that we see more and more complexity in the IT landscape. Well, everybody talks about IoT and the multi-billion number of devices we are going to see out there. And from my point of view, the only way in which we will be able to enforce security and measure security is through automation, which means that at a certain point we will need to give up on feelings, on qualitative measure, and focus much more on what we can, on data we can collect and measure. And from that point of view, SLAs are a very good initial step. They are not a panacea. They are not going to solve our problem, but certainly are a good way for start measuring and adding figures and numbers and dollar values or euro values or pounds values to the security that a cloud service or that a provider is offering to the customer.
Mm. Okay. Well, that's interesting. So we've got an argument, I think, if I understand the position, if I'm not oversimplifying it, to say qualitative may be okay at the moment, but we should be heading ideally to a much more quantitative world. Well, I hope we're going to get some questions about that, because I'd certainly like to hear a little more on that subject. But now is your chance. Do you have any questions? We have some questions from the floor. Show of hands. And when you do put your question, yes, sir, you are the first. When you do put your question, can you just say briefly who you are and any allegiance, company, etc.?
European Commission.
Sorry, say again.
Jean-Pierre Morand, European Commission. I have a question about the SLA and the SQIs. Measure, yes, but to measure what? What are good indicators of a satisfying security service today? Response time, availability, what else?
Thank you, sir. A really interesting question. So within the contract environment, in fact, what I'm going to do is put up a slide of some wallpaper. A simple vendor management lifecycle. Don't think this has got a laser in it. But we're talking about, actually, once we're in contract, how do you measure the ongoing performance, if I understand your question correctly? So start with Daniel.
Certainly, the two parameters that you have been, or features you have been mentioning are, you know, are rather important. But you are right that there is a bit of confusion in the market, and especially when it comes to SLA for security, the level of maturity is still very low. As a cloud security alliance with other organizations, we are part of an effort within the ISO community. So ISO, and specifically the SC38 standard committee, is working on SLA, on a standard on SLA. There are two issues, really, to be, two problems or challenges to be addressed. One is the definition of what you want to measure. But the other, perhaps more difficult challenge, is how do you define, in a comparable way, metrics in order to enforce that type of SLA. Because ultimately, why SLAs are important is because they should be establishing a common language that should be used by many users to compare different cloud service providers. And nowadays, we are in a situation where, if I look at the cloud market, most of the leading providers are offering a 99.95% of availability, just to make an example. And as you know very well, that figure doesn't necessarily match. Well, it's not the same. It doesn't mean the same. So the challenge for us and for the industry is really to push towards a situation where we can start comparing apples with apples. But I don't know if you were looking for specific examples of SLAs. Well, there are... Again, what we are working on are SLAs that are in the space of cryptographic strength, time of response, time elasticity of a cloud environment. We are looking at recovery time objective. We are looking at what else? From the point of view of incident management, again, beside the recovery time objective, the mean time between failure, the maximum time between failure, because there is actually a pretty big difference. Because if you want, very often, especially when it comes to failures, the average time is not necessarily a significant measurement of what you are or what you want to achieve. Because you might have one incident per year, but that single incident is actually able to put you out of business. So perhaps a more significant unit of measure would be how long does it take for you in order to discover that incident, and how long does it take for you to react? Mm-hmm. So there are many. But
can I ask one question here? Do you think that those SLAs are being actively developed and we are converging on some industry norms which will enable us to compare? And if so, how far away are we from that? Is this next year or a decade away?
Okay, the ISO standard I was referring to is divided in four parts. Part one of it, which is that just the building blocks, the definitions, is pretty much ready. The more tricky one, which is about the metrics, which is the framework that would define how a metric should be built, is quite far away to be finalized.
This is what I thought. So we're recognizing the problem. I'm going to ask the other panelists, anybody else want to come in on that question before we take another?
Yeah, I've got a take on it. I mean, I think it's a great question because ultimately, even as a security industry ourselves internally, so if you forget the outsource environment for a moment, we have the same problem, the same challenge, is how do we define key performance indicators that justify our existence? And normally, if you're functioning properly, then you could say, well, the number of incidents that you're having is reducing, potentially. But at the end of the day, it's a question that we have currently, and I don't think there's an answer. So when you extend it out into the third-party environment, I think it comes to the same conclusion, ultimately, that there are no key performance indicators that will give you assurance that the security is good enough.
And do you think that's because every situation is different and we won't come across a core set, or we simply haven't done the hard work of developing them?
I think it's because it's inherently difficult to measure something that is predicated on the number of incidents or the extent of incidents that are happening. And so we're trying to find key performance metrics, things that you can measure on a daily, weekly, monthly basis that indicate to you that your security is good enough. Yeah. But ultimately, at the end of the day, we're in a world where we need to assume that you either have been breached or you will be breached. And therefore, you're hoping to find key indicators that would tell you when that happens.
Sure.
But I don't think it exists.
Just building on that point, I think for me, the debate is almost reinforcing the need for this quantitative and qualitative mix.
Yeah.
Because I think there are dynamics around this space where threat environments, risk environments are changing very quickly, so you need to be agile. If you go back, Mike, to one of your first points, every CISO team, it doesn't matter whether it's 300 or it's 10 or whatever, you still have this issue of how much time and resource that you can spend on gaining insight into supply chain risk and then managing it. So in that context, I would still hold that a quantitative approach is actually quite resource efficient. Answer these questions. Mm. You're on the record. It's resource efficient. The dilemma is it's not giving you sufficient, and it's useful, but it's not giving you sufficient insight to really get a grip of risk. So it's for me, the qualitative approach then allows you to actually gain sufficient insight to start to change and evolve your tactics. And you might, with elements of qualitative approach, come back to the quantitative approach and say, well, we're going to change these questions. Because when we've looked at these risk assessments and looked at a bad one, a medium one, and a good one, there are issues that come out that show us that we need to change our quantitative questions.
I'm going to move on to another question. From the audience, somebody else? Okay, gentleman at the back in the far corner. I was always told that people who sit at the back in the far corners are the difficult ones. So, sir, I hope your question is going to be a challenge.
Yeah, that will follow that theme. Thank you. Bill Fagan from Kinetic. With the introduction of the Cyber Essentials Scheme, forthcoming DCPP, we also have JOSCAR, and I'm sure we could all name a whole host of other supply chain certifications and accreditation schemes that are either in flight or existing. How does the panel feel that we could manage our supply chain relationships from this attrition of answering a whole host of question sets on security, some which are very similar, and of course some of our supply chain are one man and his dog who makes a certain widget and he just says, no, I'm not going to answer that question set, or those whole host of question sets?
I think that you've got to prioritize. If you go back to Mike's first point, you've only got so much resource. You want to deal with the issue. I'm a big fan that you look at your supply chain, you look at the degree of value that they're attributing to your whole organization, and their impact on your whole organization, and you prioritize and further up the supply chain, i.e. the higher value add, greater impact suppliers. You spend more time doing qualitative work. Also, to be quite honest, in terms of efficiency, I think we could still make more of evidence escrowing. I mean, I still see lots of processes where there are manual interventions. We want to come for a site visit. We want to verify, blah, blah, blah. It's all very hugely comforting and reassuring, but it's actually, in terms of people's time, it's very inefficient. Why not escrow? You don't have to have a standard to escrow. You can just, apologies, legal services industry here, but you can approach a solicitor and just bundle up a set of evidence around the operation of certain controls, and the solicitor will escrow that evidence for you, and you can just point people who are interested at the escrowing. Yeah.
So I'm going to pursue this question because I don't think we've quite got to all of the answers yet. I think, Mark, what you've said is that we can reuse evidence, as you say, evidence escrow. But of course, that's against the backdrop that every acquirer, and you're broadly speaking as acquirers here, every acquirer has its own particular set of requirements as annex something or other to the contract. So you as the supplier, and Mark, I know you have been a supplier, so you can see this, I'm sure. As the supplier, you're faced with this range of different standards, and I'm not sure that the escrowed evidence is always going to work. So I think, as an industry, aren't we faced with this problem of multiple requests, multiple questionnaires?
Well, I agree, but isn't there a paraphrase there? You said always going to work. It's going to cover so much ground. I won't quite go into 80-20 or whatever, but isn't it likely to be pretty useful, not entirely useful, but pretty useful.
I'm going to ask one of the others, yes. Okay, is it pretty useful, slightly useful? Would you accept someone else's evidence?
If it's independent, yes. Now, as someone who's administered, who's sent out lots of these questionnaires, let me say two things. One, I do have the greatest sympathy for CISOs. Yeah. I'd rather manage security rather than answer questionnaires. Mm-hmm. I do sympathise there. A couple of things, lots of different questionnaires, they kind of all ask the same thing, just using different language and different levels of detail. But the key thing for me is self-assessment is kind of a weak form of assurance. So it's good to get an idea of what the company do, what certifications they have, do they do independent penetration testing, do they have audit reports. But I very much put more reliance on independent assurance. So an independent audit company has done an audit, and the cloud supplier make available their SOC report. That's intended to be shared between different customers. Mm-hmm. That's good for me. The key thing there is looking at the scope, make sure they've covered all the areas in scope that are relevant to you. So there's a bit of work to be done on our side, but evidence that can be shared, such as independent audit reports, based on, say, an ISO certification, to me, is quite strong.
Anybody else want to come in on that? Will?
So I think that goes back to the point I was making about flexibility, and there's part of that that's beholden on me to look at what someone's offering, see how much of what I care about that covers off, and not repeat those same questions. So whether it is an ISO, Cyber Essentials, or SOC, it's potentially other standards from other governments. If someone's been through, you mentioned Defence Cyber Protection Partnership, I should have a conversation with my colleague in Ministry of Defence. If the supplier's happy for that evidence to be shared, brilliant. I don't need to go and repeat particularly third-party assessments. If someone's had an auditor go through, I'm not going to be using my resources well if I send them to duplicate that work. But it does mean that I have to look at what's in each of those standards after I've checked the scope is appropriate and kind of tick that off the list of questions I would otherwise ask and focus on any remaining difference. It might not always cover everything, but it will take away potentially a lot of the generic questions that you would otherwise ask.
It's my job to be difficult, isn't it? But Will, you're diligent. Do you think we're all as diligent as we should be? Are we all looking at this other evidence, or do we just go, staple the security annex to the contract and send it off down the line? Do you think that's a fair criticism?
So I think
not of HMRC, of course.
I think there's still a fair amount of that. So there's still quite a lot of supplier offers. Standard A, organisation says, no thanks. Mm. We much prefer standard B.
Mm.
You know, might be 90% the same, but you know, just kind of plow it through. And there's there's a maturity required of an acquirer to not do that. Otherwise, you drive suppliers away.
Sure. The one thing that we haven't covered is the SME. I don't know whether, just before we move on to another question, anybody wants to touch on this issue about the small and medium enterprise, who very often is some way down the supply chain in large contracts, but nevertheless may be handling some absolutely vital information. Anybody want to offer a thought as to how you avoid sending your SMEs a contract which they're barely able to read through because it's accumulated so much, so many requirements as it's traveled down?
Probably a good way to look at this is that ultimately, depending on the size of the company, should also dictate the size of the third parties that you're willing to engage with. So when we look at vendors, we do typically a vendor security assessment, and it's now becoming legislated to also look at data privacy impact as part of that. And the reason you do an assessment is to determine whether you go ahead or not. So ultimately, there needs to be a decision point as the outcome of an assessment as to whether you engage with the vendor or not. And sometimes, unfortunately, depending on the size company, a small, medium enterprise may actually be too small, may not have enough control to warrant engaging with them.
But they may not be a direct supplier to you. They may be a third, second, third, fourth tier, maybe slightly invisible to you.
Well, I think it's then the notion of whether you can control all risks. And ultimately, we live in a world where, in fact, we can't. Yeah. I think we live in a world now where you could be engaging with a supplier who's engaging with another supplier, which is what you said. And ultimately, I think at the end of the day, the reality is we cannot control all of those eventualities.
Mm.
And this is where you will find that problems will come out in the future.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, sir, I don't think we got to the bottom of your question, but I think we gave it a fair airing. Now, we've got a couple of hands. Let's take the gentleman there. Then you, sir, will be second, and you'll be third.
Kevin Flood from Prudential External Supplier Team. We're a big user of ISF and various other mixes of machine learning, etc. I'd like to get on from this gentleman's point here, but there's not really enough knowledge within the information security community about contracts for me, because most of my time is spent looking at contracts, and we near enough insist every time that our schedule goes into a contract. I even got one into an IBM contract a few weeks ago, which was... but what I'm kind of wondering about is, what do you do internally? Because we try and make sure that we identify the risk when it is a small niche vendor internally, to make sure that the business is actually understanding the risk that they're signing up for.
Yeah.
Because if somebody wants to do business, particularly marketing or somewhere like that, I'll sign it, off you go. And there goes your 3 million records out, left on the bus. So, you know, I think it's more ourselves. We shouldn't really be taking on so much of the work in terms of risk assessments, etc., before we make sure that the business inwardly understands it.
Thank you very much. I'd just like to position the question on this vendor-supplier cycle. I think what you're saying, and it's something that, since you mentioned the ISF, we recognized in some of our advice, we need to get upstream in terms of the engagement. We need to be getting the security requirements, or indeed the need for a dialogue with the security office, in at the beginning, rather than that dialogue taking place, you know, the sort of phone call, hi, we're about to sign a contract, can you just look at this 500-page document and tell me it's okay? A bit late by then, so that's where I position it. Gentlemen, you heard the question. Anybody want to talk about how do you get the procurement people engaged early?
Through policies, so you need to have organizational policies and procedures.
Mm.
Unfortunately, I mean, if you work through an RFI, RFP process, that's your entry point. But so for any new engagement, any new project, internal or external, we always do a risk assessment. So always know what is the classification of the data we're going to be outsourcing, how critical is the system, you know, and that determines how much due diligence we do as well.
Sure.
I think, but the trigger at the procurement, RFI, RFP stage is key as we do the risk assessment, find out what the inherent liability is, and that drives future action.
Mm-hmm. Now, that sounds really good, but let me ask you a question there. Does that mean you see every single contract for everything, including the website that marketing are putting out and paying for on a credit card? Not that ever happens in your companies.
Our marketing people don't do that.
Yes, of course.
I take your point. We've got standard terms and conditions, lawyers and procurement. contract negotiation is quite painful sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's not just security, it's everything else in the contract. So procurement deal with that. When get red lines, when the supplier says don't agree with things, that's when my team get involved. Mm. And sometimes, you know, it's just a wording change. I'm just looking for the true meaning. So I want to insist that the supplier does penetration test reports, they patch the vulnerabilities. I don't care what the actual words are, as long as the intent is in there. It's time consuming, it's quite painful sometimes. If somebody can give me an easy way around that, I'd be very grateful.
Yeah, no, it may be painful then, but it's a lot more painful if you leave it till later, I'm sure. Anybody else want to come back on that topic?
I mean, we go through close engagement with those involved in procurement to try and do this. It is still challenging, but I think it's worth the legwork in that it will harm you throughout the length of the contract if you haven't been there at the start. And that's whether or not it's security is ignored or there's some well-intentioned but potentially misguided things have gone into the contract. A really common one is, you know, a business unit is asked whether they want more or less of something, and they go, more, brilliant. And then you have contracts with really, really punitive clauses around uptime, and you can't get something patched because the supplier just won't take something offline to do that.
Yes.
And you know, they were meant well. Mm. You would avoid that in a conversation if you sat down with the business unit and those doing procurement. Will you catch everything? No, especially not. I think I mentioned earlier there are things with no contract. Team may have just gone and downloaded some free apps to do some collaboration. You won't spot that through this means.
Yes.
But having that engagement with those involved in procurement is really key. Giving them the responsibility for issuing supplier questionnaires so they have a part in the security process kind of keeps them bought in.
Thanks. Yes, I like that. Be careful of the suppliers you don't know you have. I am going to move on to the next question, mindful of the time, but did anybody want to add any key points before I move? No, right. There was a gentleman over there. Yes, sir.
Hi there, Andy Bone. I'm the International Security Officer for Walt Disney. I just wanted to explore some of the comments that were made earlier between compliance and risk. I see that as an intrinsic set of actions for my organisation. It sort of came across from your discussions that you almost hold them separate. Can you tell me how that works? Because I can't see how risk and compliance can actually be segregated. Mm-hmm. And just one comment on this. We have a new policy where we implement all our procurement has to go through security, sign off on procurement, and sign off for legal before they can go to tender. And that works really well.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you very much. Well, I'm glad to hear that second point. Back to the first point, compliance versus risk. Who'd like to jump in there?
You're right. I agree with you. They can't be separate. They have to be integrated. And it's integrated in policies and procedures. So perhaps to give you an example, I'm not saying this is our policy. You could have a policy that says if you have an internet-facing system and it contains highly confidential data, you must have two-factor authentication. But the data's not that sensitive, then you don't need two-factor authentication. So that's an example of a risk-based approach, quite a sensible one. The other area where risk and compliance comes in is where, for some reason, you're out of compliance of a policy or a procedure. You've come out of compliance and it just happens. Then you do a risk assessment, and that risk assessment drives a priority. Absolute worst case, you switch the system off. But most of the time, it's a case of doing a risk assessment. What's the likelihood and consequence? That drives the urgency for remediation and bring it back into compliance. But ultimately, risk and compliance are integrated, absolutely.
Okay, thanks. I am going to move on to the next question. Yes, sir. And this may be the last, depending on how timing goes. So.
My name is Bertrand Sampson from GLA Consulting, the risk and advisory company. And my question would be, I think it would be great to learn that in this area, for in the next 6 to 12 months, what are the key challenge in the supply chain area that you like to overcome?
Well, thank you. Actually, what I was going to do as we wrap up was ask that very question. So rather than having 5 minutes to do it, maybe we'll take a slightly more leisurely pace and do it in 10 minutes. So I will ask the panelists now just to summarize, I think, any points that they wish they had made earlier, but I moved a conversation on, or particularly this gentleman's question. What are we heading for And somebody surely has got to mention GDPR.
Exactly. That's how I'll jump in. I mean, that's the big challenge. It's one thing to regulate, and I think we've seen with the GDPR that it's fairly onerous with quite short time frames. The question for me is resourcing, is how do we as an industry ensure that we have sufficient resource to enable us to actually perform some of these requirements? So I think for me that would be probably the biggest challenge over the next 2 years, to ensure that we have sufficient resources to be able to perform the kind of data privacy impact assessments that we need as part of not only procurement engagement, but also the standard SDLC, any changes to systems and new systems. So I think that would be the biggest challenge, in my opinion.
It's funny that you mentioned resources, though, because I thought that that would have been the wild card that you could have used, I mean, to get more resources from your board.
Yeah, but it's not about getting more. It's about the quality of it. Yeah, and if every single company in the industry is simultaneously justifying to their board to get more resource, means there's a high demand, and it's a question of supply. We just don't have the supply to fulfill the demand that is going to be created over the next 2 years. In my opinion, I might be wrong, I see you in 2 years' time, we can chat about it again.
Let's make it a bit controversial then. Yeah. So the gentleman out before from Walt Disney was mentioning the strong link between risk and compliance, and at this point, you will have the risk of not being compliant and being that risk pretty high fine to pay. Then what is GDPR is asking for is nothing that is not really reasonable, isn't it? It's just telling you, you gotta do a risk assessment, a privacy impact assessment, and then you need to implement security measures that are sufficiently good to cope with the risk you're exposing in the data of the data subject. So if we look at the situation in the bigger, at the bigger picture, is nothing new that you have done forever. At this point, there is just like a much bigger disincentive for someone not to comply with, that at this point is also the key for you to enter in the room where the decision makers are to ask for more money to get more security.
I like the argument, but Daniela, can I ask you, do you think that GDPR is intrinsically a qualitative, it demands a qualitative risk-based approach? By your own words?
Intrinsic. Well, somehow it does.
Yeah.
It does because, I mean, it's very subjective. I mean, the way you're going to measure the impact on privacy is going to be based on a number of area of impact that are not necessarily measurable with dollars figures. So, yes.
And that, of course, aggravates, I think, what we were just hearing about the shortage of skills. You can get people, but can you get the right people who can form those judgments? So, well, let's go through our sort of last thoughts. Will, what are yours?
I just wanted briefly to retouch on that kind of question around risk and compliance. So that, I think I agree with the questioner that the two should be intrinsically linked. I think where I have seen it, the two diverge. It's a warning sign.
Yeah.
So in effect, my people are spending their time forcing suppliers to spend their time complying with something that I don't care about. That shouldn't be happening. It needs to be addressed. It could have been from poor contracting. It could have been from legacy issue of some standards. Whatever it is something I can remediate. Looking ahead in terms of those big challenges, I kind of agree with the skills point, but I think I see that as something that we have throughout most of the work in this industry. I don't think there's any organization that sort of said it's suddenly got really easy to hire skilled and experienced security professionals. So I think that's a kind of challenge we'll face in any aspect of our work. I think I'll see more challenge in an increasing diversity of supply chain. The kind of continued extending length of some of the delivery chains, the number of different suppliers that are potentially combined to deliver a single service. So often we are intrinsically involved with several organizations to deliver a service rather than simply putting a larger contract out for the delivery of the totality of that service. And a lot of the pace of change is fundamentally orders of magnitude more rapid. So if I think back a few years, we used to have two very large online releases a year. Now in an organization that does 50 a week, So the way we approach, you know, looking at the quality of those releases has to be fundamentally different, and we can't put up a security gate that I force everything to go through and I personally look at, because it doesn't scale. So we have to, you know, put some of that work elsewhere in the organization and have a lot more trust internally, and some of that, you know, internal trust spreads to a kind of core of suppliers.
And take risks.
Yeah, and
I'm going to move you on, or move us on.
Yeah, I'll be brief. I think the main takeaway for me should be that you need to know who your suppliers are, and you need to have a relationship with them that you design, a strategic relationship. Mm. You need to decide how you want to engage with your vendors. And I think it's important to ensure that you do have a relationship and a functional relationship with all of your vendors.
Mm.
Sure. I think GDPR absolutely is not business as usual. I think that the challenge of confidently destroying digital data in a society and across industries that are generating more and more digital data every day is actually deceptively difficult. So it's not a BAU problem. It's something that we'll obviously all face, and it will demand some real intellectual skill as well as resources and so on. I suppose my other summary point is I really believe it's about getting this good balance of quantitative, which gives us resource efficiency over how we understand a control environment, and qualitative that allows us to sort of reinvent and get insight and stay up to speed with all these changes and get a real grip on risk. You get that balance right and you can really assess risk in supply chain far better.
Thank you, Mark. Steve?
Yeah, in looking forward 3-5 years, I see a risk, quite a big risk, in that we're tying ourselves in to cloud suppliers, especially with software as a service. So imagine we've given them all of our data, we've re-engineered our business processes to use their system. The switching costs are enormous, thinking ahead. I think that's a risk we haven't really explored very much in the industry, and I see that as being an issue in years to come. If you want to switch suppliers, it may be because they don't meet our needs anymore, they're not good enough, then that's going to be a very, very high cost.
An interesting thought, yes. And Daniela?
Well, maybe the only point to be added here is that we should start adding some flexibility in the way we conceive the procurement of services. I heard before, like, reference to very lengthy contracts. Yes, those are an issue, but in my world, I mean, number of people are using credit cards and buying cloud services. Mm. And what is going on right now, that even cloud is becoming obsolete, because we see the microservices and containers popping up in the market. That's a totally different way to conceive the production and consumption of IT services. So the sooner we have our procurement offices to get used to this new approach to buying and using IT services, the better it is.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much to the panelists. That brings us to the conclusion of this session. The organizers asked me to come up with a set of takeaways, and so I came up with this slide, and now you can compare whether I anticipated what the topics were going to be with what we actually talked about. Now, I think we were reasonably close. Watch out for the suppliers you didn't know you had, the credit card story. The relationship, it came up time and time again. The point about testing your supplier's security, not their ability to report, I think that's back to that subjective or the qualitative versus quantitative piece. Oh, yes, and we certainly talked about compliance versus risk management. We touched on this question about understanding your responsibilities. Certainly, you need to know what it means to store your data in the cloud, and a topic we covered. And we covered so much more as well. We did talk about SMEs, and we got in a little bit of discussion on GDPR. You've been a great audience as well, and thank you very much for all of your questions. Please join me in thanking our panel. Gentlemen, thank you very much.